Welcome to the West Virginia Writers Podcast, a service of West Virginia Writers Incorporated, the Mountain State's largest all-volunteer nonprofit organization dedicated to writers. Established and incorporated in 1977, West Virginia Writers continues to support writers and writing statewide through program sponsorship, an annual writing contest, and an annual summer writers conference. This podcast is dedicated to promoting the organization, its members, and events, as well as writers throughout Appalachia and beyond. And now, broadcasting from atop a hill in Mercer County, here is your host, El Presidente Emeritus.
Thank you, Gertrude, and hola, listeners. Welcome to episode 33 of the West Virginia Writers Podcast. I am your host, Eric Richues. Our guest today is one of the people I've known the longest since moving to West Virginia 9 years ago. Belinda Anderson lives in Greenbrier County, though a lot of people know her from her writing set in fictional Hope County. Among her collections of award-winning short stories published by Mountain State Press are The Well Ain't Dry Yet, The Bingo Cheaters, and Buckle Up Buttercup. She's also written for publications such as the West Virginia Encyclopedia, Golden Seal, Wonderful West Virginia, Book Page, the Greenbrier Valley Quarterly, and more. In addition to teaching a couple of workshops at the 2010 West Virginia Writers Summer Conference, she's also our nomination to become the organization's parliamentarian on our board of directors. Belinda Anderson, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you, Eric.
Now, this isn't technically your first appearance on the podcast, as we played one of our recorded live readings of you from back at the Literary Tea Series at the Greenbrier Valley Theater in Lewisburg in October. But this is the first time we've kind of sat down, so to speak, over the phone to talk.
It's going to be great to have a conversation.
It kind of struck me as strange that I haven't called you as a guest before, because you've actually served as my writing mentor for most of the 9 years I've known you, and were my introduction to West Virginia Writers, the organization, shortly after I met you back in 2001. In fact, our current president, Terry McNeimer, came to West Virginia Writers because you told him about it.
You know, I love being a missionary for West Virginia Writers, because it's a great organization, but it truly depends on grassroots support. So that's wonderful that you folks are carrying it forward, so to speak.
Well, how did you first come to join the organization? Turning the question back at you.
I think it first occurred when I attended a conference, because that intrigued me. I thought that sounded interesting. Somewhere along the way, I met the current regional representative in this area, and she asked me if I would be interested in becoming regional representative. I said, yes, I would be interested, which I thought meant, okay, let's think about this and converse further. And the next thing I knew, I was the new regional representative.
Seems to me that was kind of how I came into the organization.
it's an instant draft situation. But that was great being regional representative, because I got to bring Denise Jardina, someone I had admired very much, into our Greenbrier Valley to talk and read. Also, Barbara Smith came and presented a poetry workshop. So being a regional representative was a really good opportunity to not only help bring more awareness of literary matters to this valley, but also enrich me as a writer.
And you eventually joined the board of directors of West Virginia Writers. What offices did you serve in before?
I eventually became first vice president, and I served under George's tenure and with Kat Pleska, so that's how I came to know Kat so well.
And we mentioned before that you're our nomination for parliamentarian this year, and will, when elected, serve alongside Kat Pleska, who has been nominated as the president of West Virginia Writers for the coming season. Also, our outgoing secretary, Teresa Newsom, has been recruited as the nomination for first vice president, and our current second vice president, Susan Nicholas, will continue in that office. Interim treasurer Henry Palick will be taking over as the fully elected treasurer, and our incoming secretary nomination is Mr. Craig Snyder, who does a lot of the online newsletter stuff behind the scenes here.
It sounds like a pretty good lineup, doesn't it?
It does, and I guess one thing that we should address is you were technically on the nominations committee.
Yes, it seems as though I'm power hungry, so I think you should back up and explain how this all came about.
Well, yes, you were, being a knowledgeable person of writers in the state and people who would be good on to be nominated for offices in West Virginia Writers, Terry McNeimer recruited you to be on the committee.
And then shortly after you were recruited, former President Sandy Tritt said, well, you know, Belinda, maybe you might want to think about being on the board again. I might be willing to nominate you. And you didn't say no, per se, but the more some of us thought about it, the more it seemed like a really good fit, since you and Kat Pleska had served previously, and we really wanted to give her the most powerful board she could possibly have at her disposal for when she takes over as president. And so it just sort of made sense. And so some of us sneakily behind the scenes came in and asked you if you might be willing to do that. This wasn't a Dick Cheney situation by any stretch.
It really wasn't a coup attempt on my part.
Well, now, we're glad to welcome you back this year at the summer conference. You've been a staple of that for many years and are always one of the higher-rated presenters there. You were missing in action for last year's summer conference, but you're back this year. Can you tell us a little about the workshops you're going to be leading?
Yes, I'm really enthused about all three of them. The first one is backstory. I have found that so often, especially with emerging writers, and very often with first drafts of many of us writers, that there's an obligation to try to explain things right off the bat, and it ends up becoming overwhelming for the reader. So I'd like for writers to think of backstory in terms of a need-to-know basis, and what I'm going to do is talk a little bit about backstory, which is necessary very often, and how can you present it in ways that are engaging to the reader rather than overwhelming to the reader.
Yeah, I know that just from an acting perspective, a lot of actors take their backstory, they may craft a backstory for their characters where one does not exist in the script itself, and use that as their motivation for when they're making their acting choices. And so, very similarly, I would suppose that writers need to know a lot of the backstory of their characters, but it's not necessarily stuff that's going to be presented on screen, per se.
Yes, for instance, the first draft often serves that very same purpose that you just described. You'll start off with a really great hook, and then the next thing you know, you're backing up, you're doing a flashback, or using some other device to explain the situation. And in many instances, what you're doing is you are learning about your character's motivation yourself. And so in another draft, that could be removed and that necessary information much more subtly delivered. And that workshop will help writers with strategies for doing just that.
What are your other workshops?
I am doing two more that focus on sentence structure. And actually, as one becomes a better craftsperson, you really start to have a finer appreciation for just exactly how a sentence is constructed. So I'm going to talk about things like cumulative sentences, kernels, and maybe this sounds a little peppier, freebasing, but that's in a grammatical sense, and how you can take the structure of a sentence. Not that you would have a formula that you use, but an awareness that might help inform your choice of a longer sentence or a shorter kernel sentence, combining the two for more impact. Faulkner probably is the master of the cumulative sentence, and we'll use a few examples from him. But really, truly, I think writers will enjoy these workshops. They are designed to be one building upon the other. But if folks want to show up for the second one, I'll certainly do a review, and so you don't have to have taken the first one, I think, to enjoy the second one. So we're just going to look at the beauty of sentences and learn a bit about how to craft them in more conscious ways.
One of the other workshops that is going to be presented at the conference this year is not one that you're doing, but it's one that seems very familiar to your style of writing, at least so far as the three collections of short stories you've created are concerned. Natalie Seipolt is leading a workshop called Linked Stories, and that's going to examine short story collections with stories that are linked. And all three of your short story collections fall into that category quite well. They have characters that interact with one another and show up in one another's stories. Each individual story is a self-contained piece, but when taken as a whole, you can kind of see that you've been world building.
The thing that I like about linked stories is that you can enjoy each story on its own. But yes, indeed, there's a sort of a building sense that you're following characters. And I've even proceeded to take characters from one book and allow them to sneak their way into subsequent collections.
That was one of the things I observed back, not too long after we met. I did a review of your very first short story collection for the West Virginia Daily News, and that was one of the observations I made, was that it feels like we're pulling open a window onto a pre-existing world where everybody is there. You're looking at this town, or a county in your case, where people are interacting with one another and weave in and out of one another's lives. It's a technique I find very satisfying.
Yes, and it's fun when the UPS driver who is just passing through in one story suddenly becomes a protagonist in another. And I think you're right, that does help to enhance the sense of a realistic world that the reader has entered.
Well, I'm definitely going to have to check out Natalie Seipold's take on that, because I've seen how effective it's been in your work. The conference being just a couple of weeks away at this point, I thought I'd ask you, what are some of your more memorable moments from conferences past?
Well, I think one would have to be when, at the banquet one year, I was sitting at a table and I looked around and I thought, well, isn't this great and a little unusual that almost everyone from all the students from my current workshop are here with me? And that in itself was sort of a satisfying moment as a teacher to think that, okay, well, here are people who are now writing. Isn't that wonderful? And then I started hearing a description of myself being read aloud, and the next thing I knew, I was being presented the Just Uncommonly Good Award that I had been nominated by John Mugos for mentoring, and that meant a lot to me. That was a great evening.
Well, it was certainly a well-deserved award. I mean, at that point, I had only been to one or two of your workshops, but in the 9 years I've known you, you've become the major force as far as a mentor in my writing life goes. And you always offer insightful commentary on the work I turn in, or you're not afraid to tell me when I've written myself off a cliff plot-wise, and I know I'm not the only one you've done it for.
You know, it is a wonderful thing to, you know, when you write yourself, you're hoping that you're going to connect in some way with the reader, and so it's even better when you can foster that in another writer and know then that they are going to be making that connection with others. It's a great cycle.
Now, I think you've been primarily known for your fiction. Certainly that's what got you on the literary map of West Virginia. But your background is in journalism, and you frequently write nonfiction articles for magazines around the state and beyond. You have a current nonfiction book project, though, that I thought it might be fun to talk about a bit, which I'm actually on the periphery of myself in my role as technical advisor. Tell us a little bit about this project.
I tend to see you as wizard. To me, anyone who can make technology work is a wizard, so I appreciate that. The project began as an oral history project for Wolf Creek Mountain, which is near Alderson, with the idea being that to collect the stories of a ridgetop community that once housed maybe 30 families and now looks like Aztec ruins. So, you know, how did this mountain get settled in the mid-1700s, and why was it abandoned? I love collecting the stories from people, how they lived. And sometimes very ordinary lives have their own drama to them. It's been very satisfying to collect their testimony about their way of life.
How do you go about finding people to interview for this? Because as I understood it going into the project, there were very few people still remaining alive today who actually lived on the mountain. Many of them were grandchildren of people who had lived on the mountain. How did you track them down?
It was definitely a challenge because the mountain was pretty well abandoned in the 40s. And as you say, very few people living with direct experience. It was a process of one little clue leading to another. A challenge that I hadn't expected to have was that I had to gain trust. After all, I'm a native of the same county, but I was from the other end of the county, so I might as well have been a Yankee coming in, as far as they were concerned. So I had to sort of prove that, you know, I was a sincere person and And from there, once one door opened, then another door would open.
So how the project is still ongoing at this point?
Yes, we're collecting a few more interviews, but we're pretty close to starting to assemble the project. And, you know, once I've gotten all the interviews, then I want to provide a little historical context for it. But I think it's going to be a really great testament to our Appalachian roots. I think it's going to be something that people beyond the periphery of the area would enjoy reading as well. But let me ask you this. You've been with me on many of the treks up the mountain. Once you're on the mountain, and it's so inaccessible even today, but yet there's a to me, a feeling about it. Did you experience that?
Yes, because it's, I hate to use the cliched phrase, like taking a step back in time, but in many respects it is, because you're going up this mountain. It's not a paved road by any stretch. It's barely a gravel road. It's barely a donkey trail in places. And the only real way to access it is on foot, four-wheeler, or horse, for the most part. And there is a road system that goes over it, and some places it's better than others. But the day we were going up it was after some rains, so it was nice and muddy. And just hoofing it up, probably a mile and a half, 2 miles, up to the point where we began taking pictures, seeing some of the ruins that were up there, some of which are still in fairly good shape for ruins. I mean, these folks built their structures to last. They were craftsmen in the day. And probably the only reason there aren't more structures up there is because so much of it wound up being recycled and taken down off the mountain and repurposed for other buildings. But it was like taking a step back in time. You're seeing, so you're walking where people may not have trod for half a century.
Yeah, you may be standing where someone was the last person that walked through may have been carrying a bucket of water.
Yeah. Or moonshine.
Well, maybe not an entire bucket. And by the way, we should give a heads up for next year's conference. There are plans for me to present a workshop on just how such a project can be accomplished.
And a workshop on this subject would be quite handy, particularly for our state, because this is hardly the only community of its kind. The Wolf Creek Mountain, I imagine there are mountainous communities dotted throughout the state that maybe scant few people even know of anymore. And that would be possibly project fodder for other writers in our organization and beyond.
And that would be wonderful. The more documentation, the better. And you never know what gems you're going to discover. For instance, I found out that one of the fairly early settlers from the mid-1800s was a Confederate deserter. Now, I don't know how they procured him to begin with. That mountain is so isolated. But nonetheless, they conscripted him, but he escaped and made his way right back to that mountain where he spent the rest of his life.
And Charles Frazier wrote about it as Cold Mountain.
It does seem rather similar, doesn't it?
We've got 2 weeks left until the conference, and so I look forward to seeing you there and to attending your workshops, and hope that our listeners will join us.
Well, thank you. And I wanted to add something, if I might. You know, folks listen to your broadcasts, and they have listened to you highlighting other writers. But I think folks need to know what a good writer you yourself are. You have a wonderful imagination, and you have a great way of delivering a narrative, and I hope that folks will become more aware of you as a writer.
Well, you helped hone me, so I guess I'll let you get away with giving me that compliment. Belinda Anderson, thank you for joining us here on the podcast.
You're welcome.
Belinda Anderson teaches regular writing workshops through the New River Technical and Community College, Greenbrier Valley Campus in Lewisburg. You can find out how to sign up for those workshops, not to mention her other appearances around the state, at her website, belindaanderson.com. Belinda will also be among the featured readers of stories and poems from West Virginia Writers' anthology, Seeking the Swan, that will take place at Taylor Books in Charleston on June 23rd at 7 p.m. Our opening voiceover was provided by Marcus Vowell. Our show's theme music is used with permission by its composer, Pops Walker, who will be gracing the Assembly Hall stage along with Kippin Martin on Saturday night of this year's summer conference. This podcast is a production of Mr. Herman's Production Company Limited and was recorded atop a hill in Mercer County.